Has anything changed in the lab since winning the Nobel?
Honorable laureates, excellencies, distinguished colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Nobel Lectures in Chemistry 2024.
Welcome aboard Arlanda Express. The journey to Stockholm will take 18 minutes. Please keep the aisles free of luggage.
So this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry recognizes groundbreaking achievements in two different areas: computational protein design and protein structure prediction. So it's all about protein structures.
So you never had a long-term plan to get a Nobel?
I had no long-term plan. I never had any idea what I was doing early on. And then once I came here, I was sort of excited about what I was doing, but I wasn't really planning what was going to happen 5 years down the line.
Hi, I'm Anisha Sehgal. I'm one of the producers on the Baker Lab podcast, and I'm a grad student in the Baker Lab.
I'm Ian Hayden. I'm the head of communications and AI policy at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington.
And I'm David Baker, the director of the Institute for Protein Design.
Normally on this podcast, you hear from Ian, who interviews scientists for the show. But in this episode, you will hear me asking the questions to Ian and David about their recent experiences in Stockholm for the Nobel Prize, as well as their perspectives on the field of protein design and science communication. Okay, Ian, can you introduce the Nobel Prize for us?
Yeah, so the Nobel Prize is kind of the biggest award in science. I kind of think about it like, you know, it's kind of like the Olympics of science. You know, people like Einstein and Marie Curie and a lot of people have won, and it's given out every year in a couple different categories: chemistry and medicine, economics. For Nobel Week, I actually ended up going to Sweden because David needed to give this big Nobel lecture, and we worked together really closely on his big talk there. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday, and I'm on my way to David's house to practice the talk. This is the last weekend before he and I leave for Stockholm, and this will be the first time that we've gone through all the material together in person. Should be fun.
Ian, thanks for coming
over. No problem. Happy to do it.
Great.
Yeah, it was really just before. You're supposed to make these talks long in advance, but somehow that's never the way I do things.
We happen to have the same plane to Europe together, and so we were working on it at the airport. And then, you know, the first real practice talk that David did for the thing was in Stockholm. And what we did was we brought his family together. He'd brought a lot of family on the trip, and they put him up in this nice hotel room. And so he got his wife and his children and his parents and his sister and her spouse there.
Or you and Ian could sit here, and Daddy would sit in that chair.
Okay. I wasn't nervous in giving the lecture. It was fun. But it was, the hardest part was I gave a practice talk for my extended family, who all came with me, which was really wonderful. And they were extremely critical with pretty much every aspect of it.
Anyway. Okay. So... Actually, right now I'm thinking I'll start on the second slide.
Okay.
Wait a second. This is falling
out. Okay. Are we ready to go?
Yep.
Here we go. Okay. Start at the beginning.
So, but once I got through that, giving the actual talk was a piece of cake.
How did the lecture go?
I felt like the lecture went fine. I give a lot of talks, so for me it wasn't that big a deal. It was a little bit of a different audience. What I learned, one thing that I only found out afterwards, because it was hard to see into the audience, after it was over, I went into the audience and there was a whole large section of the room, which was all the my wonderful former students and postdocs and, you know, other people in the Rosetta Commons. And I didn't know that when I was giving the talk, which was good because I would have been much more stressed about giving a talk to people who actually knew about what I was talking about than giving it to just a general audience. But it was, that was really the highlight of the talk for me, was afterwards, going out and talking to my family, and then discovering there was this huge group of friends from long ago who were there. The most dramatic thing that happened at that point is my good friend and hiking partner, Phil Bradley, had somehow managed to embed his phone into a seat in the Nobel Prize auditorium. And so he was starting to walk out with the whole seat, and he got stopped by a guard.
We've kind of broke the lecture hall a little bit. And also we overstayed our welcome. They had to kick the group out by the end.
It seems like you brought more people to Stockholm for Nobel Week than any prior Nobel laureate. Why did you invite so many people?
The prize is really a recognition of the work of a really large community of people and over many, many years. And so I think it was only right that everyone who was involved, or at least many of the people who were involved, came to Stockholm to celebrate.
I'll just ask, who made up that group of invites? Who showed up?
Well, there were former students and postdocs, many of whom, I think 60 or so of whom, who were there currently have faculty positions around the world. There were current trainees, students and postdocs from my group, who are kind of leading the charge into the new era.
I thank my family for their love and support, and my colleagues over the years who made the science incredibly exhilarating. Let's raise a toast to making the world a better place.
Yeah, it was an incredible turnout. We discovered actually from another person who had won a Nobel Prize that if you're willing to foot the bill, you can bring as many people as you want. And once David learned that, the doors flew open. So I think we ended up having, more than 200 people.
What did you think of David's remarks just now?
I'm almost crying, I would say. Yeah? Yeah, it's really touching, especially when he mentioned that, the whole community and, the immigrants, right? All together that make all this happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you do?
I'm still doing research, still doing protein design. I still make it glow.
Amazing.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
And it was a really special thing. I think if David could have had 1,000 people there, he would. I think he's a big believer in the fact that, science is something that's done by scientists. It's never really just one lone genius who makes some critical discovery. Everyone's work builds on the work of prior people, but even the way labs actually operate, the person running the lab, of course, is an essential part of what the lab does, but they're not the sole person responsible for the work. In fact, they're not doing most of the work. They're not most of the people there. And so I think as much as possible, David has always tried to connect any success that he's had with the people who were there to do the work. And I think that was really one of the reasons why this group of people grew to be probably the biggest group to ever attend a Nobel Week for a single laureate, is because we really wanted to show that it's not just one person who does this.
If it's going to work, is you hold this.
Okay.
Right there. We'll have a little ambient. So first, just so we have it, say your name and where you are.
Brian Weitzner, Grand Hotel in Stockholm.
Where do you work?
I work at Outpace Bio in Seattle.
Excellent. All right. You were just telling me an interesting story about a time you went to RosettaCon. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, I remember very vividly. I went to a RosettaCon conference, and at the poster session, I saw somebody had a poster up that was very, very similar to what I was working on, and I was so deflated. And I told my PhD advisor, what am I going to do? And he was like, "Who cares? Who gives a shit? You're a smart guy. You'll come up with more ideas. But also, let's call them up and see if they want to collaborate. We'll probably do a better job if we work together anyway."
What do you think that story means? Why do you think that's a significant thing for you?
I think it means that the space is so big that we're not competing for success. There's no one else's success is a threat to mine.
Is that something you feel in the work you do now?
Absolutely. And I feel it particularly in this community of researchers, in the resident community, where when someone's successful, everyone's just there to celebrate their success and then to also share their own successes back. And there's an expectation that everyone's just going to be rooting for pushing science forward together.
That's awesome. We're here celebrating. What have you thought about this week so far?
This has been the most surreal and incredible experience that I've had as a part of my career. I've felt that a large part of what we've done for a long time has been seen as sort of fringe and weird. I remember hearing a lot of like, oh, cool model, but is it science? It's extremely validating, and obviously David has played a singular role in all of this work, but hearing him take every opportunity he has to acknowledge the community effort and everybody working together has just been an extremely moving experience. I've definitely been wiping tears away.
Me too.
All week. I think the applications of what we can do with the tools that we've built and the technology that we're pushing forward is so much bigger than any one field. It's going to touch everything, and I think it's going to go beyond scientific history, and it's going to be something that we look at as changing human history.
This event was just a series of favorite moments. Just to see people so happy, to people to have accomplished something together, to see David smiling with everyone around him, applauding and cheering, that was just one of the most happy moments I've had in my life.
Has anything changed in the lab since winning the Nobel?
No, and it's very nice. Very little has changed, and so I come into work, and it's the way it always was. Well, I think what I hope is that it creates even more enthusiasm and excitement over the area, about the area, so that more and more, younger scientists, you know, students or postdocs decide to go into it and, you know, make their fortune here. There's so many great problems to solve. So I think that's really the the positive that would come out of it. So my advisor, thesis advisor, Randy Sheckman, was there, and he gave a little speech pointing out that there is now a chain of Nobel Prize winners. He got a Nobel Prize. I have a Nobel Prize. And so there was people in the audience, at least one of them was going to get a Nobel Prize. And then I realized I've had a lot of students and postdocs. So if you scale it, then I sent out a message to everybody saying I was expecting three Nobel Prize winners in the next generation. So everyone's getting busy trying to work towards that.
I think that's a funny story, but I also think there's like actually some truth behind that. I think, you know, an unusual feature of this prize is in a way it marks the beginning of a field.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I really feel like things are at the beginning, not an end. And so I was very excited to get back to Seattle. And I'm actually more excited about research now than I ever have been. There are just so many really exciting applications. And the things that we're working on now are really things I could not have imagined doing even just like 4 years ago. So I think, what we've done already is sort of interesting, but I think the really exciting stuff is still to come.
Could we get people excited for a minute? Tell me about two of those things that are happening now that you actually maybe thought couldn't have happened before or were unlikely that you now think are maybe likely going to happen in protein design.
Yeah. Well, there are actually many examples. I'll just choose two. One is that in biology, there are nanomachines that, for example, power movement, among other things. And so they basically use a chemical fuel to drive a motor along a track, for example. And I think there's now enormous possibility of designing new machines for all kinds of purposes out of proteins. And so that's one very exciting area that I think could really transform both kind of nanotechnology and medicine. And then in a completely different area, there are really amazing materials in nature like tooth and bone and seashells that are made out of proteins interacting with inorganic compounds like calcium carbonate. And I think there's enormous potential now for designing new proteins that template the formation of new materials from not only sort of things like calcium carbonate and calcium phosphate, which are really interesting in themselves, but also other types of compounds, which are semiconductors, which would give completely new ways of making, you know, new and useful materials.
So your answer covered this, but I want to ask it in a slightly different way. It seems like a lot of progress to date in protein design has had to do with medical applications, things like cancer medicines or the first approved de novo design medicine, which was a vaccine. and that work is still happening. But it seems like increasingly there's more possibility to work on non-medical applications of protein design, working beyond medicine. Do you think that trend is true? And what do you see as some of the most interesting examples?
Yeah, I think there are some really important problems in sustainability that protein design is very well suited now for addressing, like destroying or degrading plastic, for example, is something that we're actively working on. We've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years in designing catalysts that will speed up chemical reactions. And so things like breaking down plastic or converting methane to methanol to remove methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas from the atmosphere. I think these are really great challenges that protein design is now well suited for tackling.
If there's some students listening, what would you say to maybe an undergraduate or someone who's interested in science, any number of different fields of science, who thinks this work is interesting? Do you have any advice on how they can get into this kind of work?
Well, I guess I have two types of advice. One is, if you find this interesting, it's good to learn this in a place where people are actively doing protein design, but there are more and more universities now which have faculty who are working in this area. And I think there's about to be a lot more because there are many outstanding scientists who are now applying for faculty positions. That's one. And then the other is, don't plan too far ahead, because I never imagined when I was in college or even graduate school that I'd be designing proteins one day. So I would say at any stage, just try and do what you think is most exciting. And that's a pretty good recipe. Don't make really long-term plans for your career.
So you never had a long-term plan to get a Nobel?
I had no long-term plan. Yeah, I never had any idea what I was doing early on. And then once I started doing, once I came here, I was sort of excited about what I was doing, but I wasn't really planning what was going to happen 5 years down the line.
David, you mentioned that you give a lot of talks, and that's true. Why do you give so many talks?
Well, first of all, what was very unusual about this talk for me was that it was in person. So I give many talks, but I never travel, and I do them over Zoom. In fact, this morning I gave a talk in Austria. I give talks. So the reason I don't travel is I really feel like my job is to be in my lab, mentoring, trying to mentor students and postdocs and other people in the lab, and really trying to be involved as much as I can in pushing the research forward. And I don't really like travel and hotels and planes and stuff. But Zoom is nice because I can give talks remotely. I think part of the job of a scientist is to communicate the science, and giving talks is a good way of doing that.
So we've talked about the Nobel Prize and the work that Ian and David put into presenting the Nobel lecture. But Ian, many listeners don't know that you were a graduate student in the Baker Lab, but also went through a transition to your current role as a science communicator. Can you tell me more about what your role is and how you got here?
Let's see, that's a big question. You know, my story is maybe not the most typical of somebody who ends up as a grad student in a Nobel laureate's lab, but to me, it makes all the sense in the world. In high school, I really was not a good student at all. I actually barely graduated high school. And, you know, looking back, the reason for that really is high school didn't engage me. I didn't really see the point. And I ended up graduating from high school, and I ended up at a community college, mostly because they would take me. I didn't have much of a GPA. You know, I think they're really important because they give people just like me that opportunity. So my experience there is I discovered right away that, unlike high school, I could build my own schedule. I could take the classes that I wanted. And that's kind of all it took. At that point, I was like off to the races. So I ended up taking physics and chemistry and a bunch of science classes and a bunch of art classes, all because I found them interesting. And I really fell in love with organic chemistry. That sort of sent me down a professional track that I had been on for a while. I did community college for 2 years. I ended up transferring to UC Davis and graduated there after a year. And then I ended up working in the biotech sector for a couple of years, working at an enzyme company. I love that. And that was really where science became more than just like an academic interest of mine. It really was my job for the first time. And as part of that job, I read a lot of research papers that were relevant to the work we were doing. And I kept coming across protein design and kept coming across this guy, David Baker. And I read a lot of the papers from the lab then and really discovered that, you know, this was, to me, the most interesting science. I was a biochemist. I was very interested in enzymes and how they work and could we make custom ones. And the Baker Lab then and now publishes on exactly that. So it's quite clear to me that if I was going to go to grad school, I should go try to work with this guy, David, and try to make enzymes with him. So I ended up joining David's lab and doing enzyme design research here. And I finished most of my PhD, but I ended up leaving the program with the master's and made a bit of a career pivot during grad school because I sort of discovered that I was maybe not the best pipetter in the world, or at least I'd done enough protein purification in my time, and that my skills were better used elsewhere. And I discovered sort of the world of science writing and science communication as a grad student, and I realized that, I think I was better suited for it, and frankly, I enjoyed it more. And so I made a pivot halfway through my PhD and ended up taking a staff role as a science communicator here at the Institute for Protein Design. So I didn't change my desk, but I did change my role within the group.
Was there a very pivotal moment for you while you were training, while you were a PhD student in the Baker Lab, that really made you want to move into science communication as opposed to staying as a more traditional bench lab scientist?
I saw a flyer one day for a workshop. So I go to this workshop, and it was an editor who works at this news outlet. And it's a really interesting outlet. It's called The Conversation. They publish on all kinds of different topics. What's unique about them is every story is written by some expert in that topic. So they really exist to connect experts in different communities with a wide readership. And so that's what this workshop that I ended up going to, the seminar, was about, was explaining their model and basically looking for writers. And it was, you know, interesting timing. The project I was working on as a grad student, what my research was about, was enzyme design. And the types of enzymes that I was working on back then were phosphatases, organophosphatases. It's this really obscure class of enzymes that on its own is probably not that interesting, but the week that this seminar happened was the same week, coincidentally, that was back during the Syrian civil war. And it was one of the first instances where the Syrian government used chemical weapons against a bunch of civilians, and a lot of people died. And it turns out that the chemical weapons used there and used in a lot of places are a class of compounds called organophosphates. And so the types of enzymes I was working on, organophosphatases, are the enzymes that break down that type of chemical. And so what ended up happening is I wrote an article pretty much as soon as I got home after that workshop. Basically the piece ended up being, chemical weapons are this awful thing that have just been used. They were made by scientists originally as a deliberate warfare program, and there are scientists who are trying to unmake them. And I really enjoyed that, and I liked writing the piece, and it got republished in a couple of different places, Scientific American and other places, and it kind of got me going, and I ended up writing, like a dozen more stories in the next couple of years for that outlet, and that really was the pivotal moment that led me first into sort of writing as a hobby, and then ultimately into science writing and science communication now as my career.
And so when you realized that you wanted to make that pivot, how was the transition? I mean, David was your advisor at the time. What was that experience like trying to get to move into a science communication role?
I had been writing basically on the weekends as a grad student for a little while and enjoyed it. And then I found this opportunity to do a fellowship that would take me out of the lab for a summer and put me into a newsroom. I ended up at a newspaper, and it was an awesome program. It took PhD students, people in STEM, and put them into newsrooms to try to bridge this gap. And I loved it. It was really that experience, that summer away, that convinced me, okay, maybe this is more than a hobby. Maybe this is something I could actually do full time. And I should say, David's role in the story is one of a really supportive mentor. And when I came to him one day and I said, hey, David, I think I'm going to take like a whole summer off because I actually won this fellowship. And, his response immediately was, that's great. If you think that's going to help you figure out where you're going with your career, then he said he's all for it. And, when I came back and broke the news that, hey, actually, I liked it so much that I think I'm probably going to drop out of this PhD program, I mean, I don't think he was thrilled with that, but I think he was happy that I, you know, it seemed like I found a career move I could make that would be helpful for me. And, you know, this is the part where I usually advise people not to try to recreate what I did. It just so happened at the time that, you know, David works at the Institute for Protein Design. He's the founder and the director here. And the Institute was growing a lot at the time and actually had a need to do a lot of science communication and do a lot of writing kind of urgently. And so right, basically, as soon as I broke the news to David and others that I would be leaving, I sort of said on the, you know, if I love the research that's happening here, if there was ever some part-time work, you know, I'd be interested. And that pretty quickly turned into a new full-time job. And so I've been working that job ever since.
And now you're head of communications at the IPD.
And now we got a podcast.
Yeah. What is your experience working with David?
Oh, that's a big question. So I guess I've worked with David for a while now and a couple different roles. So, you know, my earliest interaction was a prospective grad student. So I wanted to impress the guy and I wanted to get into the program and I'd read a lot of his work and probably came on a little too strong and was very nervous to meet David initially. And, you know, I was a trainee in his lab and got to know him a bit better, you know, after interview weekend and being in the program and working with him day to day and seeing the type of mentor that he was. And then for the last several years, I've been a colleague, or he's been my boss. And so that's really a different kind of relationship, but I've gotten to know him more. You know, I'm certainly less nervous around the guy. I think he's a phenomenal scientist, and what makes an institute like this work is not just having one smart person or a bunch of smart scientists. You know, running an institute, running a big operation is a complicated thing. And so it takes many people with many different kinds of expertise to run a big operation. And so that's a part of the job that I love a lot, is I get to work with someone who's a great, phenomenal researcher like David and the hundreds of trainees who've been here during my time, but also many other kinds of experts who bring really important and unique skills to the mix.
So David had mentioned when we talked to him that part of being a scientist is communicating your work. That is such a large component. It's not just pipetting or, you know, running code to plot your data. So I guess I want to hear some words from you kind of tying that together, like being part of a scientist is communicating your work.
Yeah, so why science communication? Science is so specialized to the point of being siloed that, you know, and it's a necessary feature. The work is very technical and it's very complicated, but that level of technical detail, that level of jargon, you know, it serves a function within a certain scientific community and a scientific context. It's how professionals communicate with one another efficiently, but it is itself a barrier to being accessible, being broadly understood. And I think people have this confusion that, well, making something accessible means dumbing it down. And I think that's just a fundamental mistake. You know, I think just because someone in my department can't easily understand what everyone else in every other department is doing, it doesn't follow that they're dumb. It's actually just that this stuff is really complicated and technical, and it benefits at times from removing that layer of technical presentation that really is only accessible to people in the field. Stripping that away, trying to preserve what's true and interesting about the work so that that work can reach more people than just your lab mates, your department, or the type of expert community that you might be a part of, whether it's at a company or whatever. So I think science communication is critical both within science and beyond. It's the most effective way of bringing new knowledge, new discoveries, new insights, new hope, new opportunities to a lot of different people who I think are really interested in that. You know, I think there's something natural, and you know, you see it in kids all the time. Kids generally love science. They love dinosaurs. They love whatever it, flowers, whatever it is they're interested in. People have this innate interest in the world, in nature, in discovery. But most people don't end up becoming scientists, and I think they sort of become detached from scientific fields, technical fields. So I do think it's really important, most especially if, like us, you work at a public university. We're funded mostly through taxpayer dollars or donated money. And it's really important to not just do the work and tell our smart friends about it. We also need to tell everyone about it, including people who are smart in their own right, but don't speak the same language that we do.
But do you have any advice for scientists who maybe they are in the midst of their PhD or master's program, or maybe they're on the tail end of it and they're like getting ready to, you know, apply for postdoc positions or industry jobs, and they just have that thought in the back of their head of, what if I want to try science communication? Do you have any advice on how to go about pursuing that?
Yeah, for sure. I encourage, especially grad students. You know, grad school usually takes a long time, and the way I look at it is, you're really doing it as a student going through the program. You're doing it for you. You're not doing it for the person who runs your lab. You're doing it to advance yourself, your career, however you think about it. And so you should be pretty deliberate about making choices that are good for you. And that might be following a path that looks like a path that a lot of other people follow. And it might look like for you following a different kind of path where you sort of have to make some changes and make things up as you go. So if you're somebody out there, you're considering science communication, I think the most important thing you could possibly do is start. You just need to start. I think I spent months and years thinking about what I might do instead of doing anything. If I could change that, I certainly would. So what does starting look like? You know, I think start with what's around you. You know, if you are part of a department, can you write something for your department? Can you make a video? Can you use social media on behalf of your lab or colleagues or university or whoever in a way that brings science or whatever your interest is to the world? And I think just starting with what's around you and what's available, that is sort of the necessary first step for really engaging in this stuff. And you'll pretty quickly discover that there are way more opportunities out there than you realize. There are these fellowships, there are programs, there are degrees you can get. But it's not easy to find those things if you're just in lab wondering if something else is possible. It is possible, it's out there, but it just takes a lot of proactive steps.
How do you see the future of science communication?
I think that's tricky. I think science communication, to the extent it's just sort of part of media writ large, I think is going through a ton of change for all kinds of reasons. And I think it's changing really quickly. And so entire, social media platforms that used to be harbor a lot of good scientific debate and discussion can go away. I think we've seen that, and new ones that try to crop up, and the type of reporting, the way people read the news and consume information changes every couple months, it seems. And so I think science communication, like all of media right now, is in a period of really extreme change. So I think if you're a younger person or just starting your career, that can be a huge opportunity. It kind of, the way I think about it is, we're in a let's try stuff and see what happens moment. And so I think especially if you're just starting out, again, just trying stuff, maybe it's short form videos, maybe it's written words, maybe it's a documentary, I don't know. But I think putting material out there and finding a way to share what you want to share and reach people that you want to reach, I think there's more ways to do that now than ever.
Thanks for listening to the Baker Lab podcast. I'm your host for this episode, Anisha Sehgal. This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington School of Medicine. It was produced by Ian Hayden, Preeti Biswas, Nora McNamara Bordwick, and me, with help from Roni Weissman, Joe Min, and Nathan Greenwood. Our music is by Kevin McLeod and John Woods. Please subscribe and leave a rating if you like the show, and we'll see you next time.